This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Futuro.
Just a quick warning. There is some explicit language in this conversation, so be aware.
So I'm investigating myself, I'm investigating her, and I learn how to see her as a separate human being, not as my mother, as a person. Why did she make these decisions? What kind of world was she growing up in? What was her home like? You know, all of these questions that shape us as people, I wanted to apply to her. To see her with empathy enabled me to go to these scenes, to go to these memories, to feel as if she's there.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a conversation with journalist and author Carmen Rita Wong about her memoir, Why Didn't You Tell Me? Over her 20-year-long career in the media, Carmen Rita Wong hasn't been afraid to ask the hard questions. Carmen began her career specializing in something that often can be difficult to talk about, money.
Money is about not just money. It's also about how you live your life, how happy you want to be. So here's the thing, with every decision you make in your life, there's a personal cost and a financial cost.
As a personal finance expert, Carmen was named host of On the Money on CNBC in 2005, making her one of the few Latinas to host a show on national television. She's also written 2 personal finance books, and her work has been featured in publications like Essence and Glamour magazines. But as a woman of color, and often the only woman of color in the spaces of finance journalism, race, gender, and identity were always on Carmen's mind. Born in New York City in 1971, Carmen grew up with an Afro-Dominican mother and a Chinese father. She recalls early childhood memories drinking café con leche on her abuela's couch in Upper Manhattan, and then driving down to Chinatown, where her father, Papi Wong, would take her and her brother to restaurants decked in gold and red.
The restaurant was overwhelming in size, filled with gold chairs as far as my eyes could see, and red, so much red, and people and chatter everywhere. Eyes were on us. When our father, Peter Wong, entered a space, no matter the expanse, he made sure you heard and saw him coming.
Carmen would later understand that this marriage between her mom, Lupe, and her dad, Papi Wong, was only a strategy for her immigrant family to legally remain in the United States. And so, when Carmen was a little girl, her mom, Lupe, divorced Papi Wong, and she got married again, this time to a man Carmen describes as her mom's white knight in shining armor. Her stepfather, Marty, was the family's ticket now to the white suburban American dream. But it wasn't like she'd imagined it. The family moved to New Hampshire, to a neighborhood where Carmen didn't see many people who looked like her. Soon, her mom stopped cooking Dominican food, and the family stopped speaking Spanish. It was the price they paid to fit in.
Our new house was in the tiny town of Amherst, off a main road called Route 101, which was 2 paved lanes that cut through farmland. Only a few years in New Hampshire, out of the city, and my visual comprehension was shifting. It was like I had white lenses over my eyes, the white gaze. The gap between the new us and our own family back in Manhattan kept getting larger.
Lupe and Marty would go on to have 4 more kids in New Hampshire. Carmen remembers growing up feeling like an outsider, even in her own family. And questions about belonging followed her as she came of age. Decades later, as Carmen's mother neared the end of her life, the secrets began to come to the surface.
My youngest sister only recently gave me a photograph that she had found in our dad's closet. If I had seen it at any point in my first 3 decades on this earth, it would have burst my life and our family's lives wide open.
Carmen, who is now 51 years old, turned to writing in order to make sense of why her mother decided to keep these secrets for 30 years. Why Didn't You Tell Me follows that journey. In my conversation with Carmen Rita Wong, we dive into her family's story, her career as a woman of color in journalism, and how the art of memoir writing can sometimes feel like a radical practice of empathy. Carmen Rita Wong, welcome to Latino USA. It's been, honestly, like forever. Forever in the making. Welcome, welcome. Yes.
Oh, it's what a pleasure and an honor, Maria. It's like the universe came full circle. I'm so happy.
You know, you and I actually, we really could talk for hours. And we have.
Yes, we have. We have.
In our desayunos. And, you know, before we became friends, I admired you from afar.
Same.
Because you were a journalist making a space for yourself as a woman of color. You've had this incredible 2-decade career span in the media. And then you dove into writing a memoir. Mm-hmm. And when I mean dive in, you dove in deep because your memoir really is all about family secrets. It's about race. It's about colorism. It's about gender. It's about fitting in and exactly what that means and how all of this has shaped you. And I've always wanted to ask you this question. You know, there was a moment when you decided, okay, I want to write a memoir as opposed to I want to write another novel. Mm-hmm. So where were you in your life when you were like, okay, it's a memoir. I have to do this.
You know, I have actually always wanted to write, not from any feeling of self-importance, but from a feeling of being that kid in middle school among the library stacks and looking up for my next book to read and not seeing us, not just me, not seeing us at all. And I always wanted to fix that.
You know, I'm like, well, one of the things that Carmen Rita and I actually never talked about is investigative journalism. And for you, this notion of investigative journalism has really been understanding your family's history, your mom, the decisions that she made and how this all shaped you. And so Can you paint us a picture of who young Lupe Altagracia was back in the days when she was raising you and your brother Alex as a single mom in New York City? Take us to that time.
She was a very stylish woman. That kind of ran in the family. You know, her and my abuela were seamstresses for Oscar de la Renta. And I would try on her high heels and lipstick and all of that. She wasn't around as much. During that time, what I remember the most are all the other family around me. She was there, but, you know, she was working. My mother was, you know, not the warmest person. So it really was my abuela who was a big force in my life, in the start of my life. And I can smell her kitchen and her little plastic fruits on the table. And like all of these things were just so much, you know, the vinyl on the furniture in the summer, I would just sweat and just stick. And these things are so bright in my mind. And then it was Chinatown.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the marriage between your mom and Peter, who you call Papi Wong. So this is your mom's first husband, and she married him when she arrived from the Dominican Republic as an immigrant here in New York City.
Yeah. So Abuelo Eugenio, who brought my mother, brother, sister, and abuela to the city, was married and had another family, you know, typical, and brought both families. But the trouble was, of course, because they weren't legally married, the family couldn't, you know, get their documentation. And what he did, entrepreneur that he was, somehow found these two Chinese gangsters, like literal gangsters, which is, you know, wild when I think about, you know, what I've come from, but to marry for money his two daughters, my mother and my tia.
Whoa. So it was straight up like this is a transactional thing.
You know, they needed their documentation. These Chinese gentlemen had theirs. And my cousins are the Lees. And we're the Wongs and they're the Lees. It was not the most auspicious beginning.
Oh my God.
To have an arranged marriage to someone who, you know, doesn't exactly operate on the right side of the law. But Papi was my father for the first 31 years of my life. And my brother is my heart, or was my heart. And he was a Wong. So yes, it was a very interesting time. Papi would come and pick my older brother and I up, the two Wongs, his two Wongs. Abuela would doll us up and my mother, and we'd go down to Chinatown and he'd show us off. And their relationship, you know, if you look at the pictures, my favorite picture, which is one of the ones on the front of the book, that's their engagement party. And my mother's wearing, you know, a Chinese Changsam mm-hmm. dress mm-hmm. and has her beehive. Mm-hmm. And Papi has his hair, you know, slicked back. And they're in Chinatown with my Dominican family.
When you're a young girl, your mom leaves Papi Wong. Mm-hmm. She remarries. And she kind of takes you as far away from Upper West Side, Harlem, mm-hmm. Chinatown, New York. She takes you to New Hampshire. Mm. And, you know, you talk about how, yeah, it might have been just a drive away, but really the culture of these places is so different.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of this New York kid, New York Latino, Dominican family. Your mom, you have this scene in the book where your mom goes to the supermarket with, you know, típico rolos in mm-hmm. her hair.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could read this passage that takes us back to that moment.
As we claimed a shopping cart and walked into the local grocery store, my mother, who I thought was beautiful and arguably striking, wore in her hair large rollers, as fat and round as Coke cans, covered by a beautiful silk scarf tied at the back of her neck. And the scarves. Ugh, I loved the scarves. My mother had a drawer of them that I would sneak into and drape around myself to pretend I was just as glamorous as her and all her friends. The grocery aisles in our new town were enormous compared with what we were used to. The store itself appeared to be a full city block of unlimited supplies. We shared a mutual bubbly excitement, my mother, my brother, and I, as we first walked in the doors. Then, as we wound through the aisles, the metallic sounds of our shopping cart sounded louder as every person we passed went silent and stared at us, at my mother in particular. They stared, sneered, and stifled laughs. I saw their ugly faces first before I saw my mother's stoic but pained expression as she kept shopping for what our family needed until we reached the last aisle, my brother and me silently following. Mom then steered us to the checkout line. After 10 aisles of stares and whispers, her face was burning with shame and maybe even anger. Her back was straight, chin up, jaw set as she unloaded the groceries from our cart. Registering this look like I'd never seen on my proud mother's face, I caught another woman just over her shoulder, staring at Mommy and whispering to another shopper. The woman looked at me, and I sent burning daggers their way with my little eyes, even though I was so sad and afraid. I never saw my mother in rolos in public again.
What do you think were the lesson, the big lesson that you learned in your life because of this transition of, I'm leaving New York and I'm going to New Hampshire?
Well, I might as well have, you know, 4-hour drive. I might as well have been on Mars, you know, or the moon in 4 hours. Like, that's how different it was. The takeaway from it really is that pressure in that culture, not Harlem, not Dominican, not Chinatown, in the white culture of New Hampshire in the late 70s, early 80s, and maybe even now, of course, is about erasure and its theft. Assimilation is a theft that is so painful. It breaks families, it breaks traditions, it breaks identity. But the odd good part of it was I got insight into how the culture that tends to run things in this country, how they think, how they act, why they do, and it demystified all of that for me. So that was really something I just took with me my whole life.
Coming up on Latino USA, I continue my conversation with Carmen Rita Wong and how the experience of writing a memoir has helped her understand the often difficult decisions she and her family had to make. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back. Before the break, we were talking with Carmen Rita Wong about her memoir, Why Didn't You Tell Me? In the book, Carmen grapples with the family secrets her mother, Lupe, kept for 30 years. We're going to dive back into my conversation now with Carmen. We're going to talk about how growing up in a predominantly white environment shaped her career as a journalist and how her own journey as a mom and as a writer brought her closer to understanding her mother's complicated decisions. So the title of your book is Why Didn't You Tell Me? And you're like, I just wanted answers. And I feel like you and me as kind of modern Latina moms, we're about like, we're going to give you the answers. But, you know, we recognize that it's also challenging. Mm-hmm. In the book, though, what you do is that the title, you take this title, Why Didn't You Tell Me? And each chapter of the book basically is, well, why didn't you tell me? Because dot, 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 dot. And I was wondering, who are you asking this question to?
My mother's ghost. My mother's ghost. Because each is, you know, because the stage was set. And that's the chapter about, you know, the origin story, right? And the dais in Chinatown with the bosses on it and the dance floor that my mother would have on a Friday night in her apartment, you know. So each chapter title gives you a hint as to, you know, what my mother may have been thinking or saying is like, well, this is the way things were. One of them is we moved to New Hampshire because white is right, because it's too late, because I didn't think you would find out, you know. But it really literally was the way I saw my life unfold. And by always keeping in mind that theme of figuring out why she didn't tell me, because she went to her grave when I found out at 31 years old, I was told that Poppy Wong was not my biological father, which was devastating. I confronted her and she was dying of cancer. And, you know, she told me a whole nother story, Maria.
Not only your mom, I mean, the lies upon lies in my own extended family in Mexico. It's like, you want to hear a telenovela? The stories that are layered one on top of the other and trying to keep them all straight is one thing. And I'm thinking about your mom. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that there she is, you know, with not a lot of time left, and she's able to kind of talk about this whole other story and make up another story for you, her daughter, right? And so I'm thinking about, as you're writing this book, this happened a lot for me as I was writing my memoir. I ended up having a lot of conversations with my dad. There was a lot of, for me, with my dad, I was like, ay, perdón, papi, I put you through that. Oof, perdón. With your mom, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you worked with writing those particular scenes between you and your mom. So talk a little bit about that communication with your mom as a writer.
Well, I think it's not her per se. It's not even necessarily her ghost. It's more like, what would I say or ask or do if she were here and there was a big glass wall between us? Because that's the distance I have to hold her. She could be quite the damaging person. So what it enabled me to do all this time that she's been gone, she passed 18, 19 years ago, it's enabled me, plus 15 years of weekly therapy, mujer, that is so important. Talk about investigative journalism. You must investigate yourself, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm investigating myself. I'm investigating her. And I learn how to see her as a separate human being, not as my mother, as a person. Why did she make these decisions? What kind of world was she growing up in? What was her home like? You know, all of these questions that shape us as people, I wanted to apply to her and see her, not with forgiveness, by the way, because forgiveness requires an apology and a change in behavior, so, but empathy. To see her with empathy enabled me to go to these scenes, to go to these memories, to feel as if she's there.
So growing up in New Hampshire, being one of the only people of color in your school, in your neighborhood, it was, you say, often painful, very, very isolating. But you also say that it demystified the way that white America operated, right? The fact that you felt demystified by it all led you to then kind of make the career choices that you made, which were, you know, frankly, pretty badass. You know, you start by working in magazines. You go into personal finance. I remember I was like, say what? And we've talked about this. I'm like, oof, money? And you're like, I'm diving in. And I'm wondering, we've actually never sat down and like commiserated because it's like, eso pasó.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that when you were writing this, you were like, oh my God, the things that I had to put up with. And I'm wondering about those early moments of your career.
Oof. I tell you, Maria, I looked back and I finished that book and I was like, oh, no wonder I'm so tired. Jeez. Jesus. Ay. It's like a tired to the soul. The demystification part of it was, you know, Marty, my stepfather, was in graduate school for economics at Columbia, the complete opposite of Poppy Wong, right? I tried to bond with him because, you know, here's this new dad. And then I had four little sisters from their marriage and I wanted to be part of something. And, you know, it was mostly the Wall Street Journal and Louis Rukeyser on PBS. And it was all about money, money, money. So I knew all this stuff, but I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I loved media. I loved magazines. We were a news family. Lupe, mommy, taught me to speak with this very distinct voice by watching the news. She didn't want me to have an accent. And my career was a bit haphazard because, frankly, her dreams for me was what I had to start out with. I'm a creative. I wanted to create. I loved art. I loved writing. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be a psychologist, which I did get my master's in psychology. But I really wanted to do those things, and I wasn't allowed to. So pre-med, graduated with a double in art history and psychology, started at Christie's Auction House on Park Avenue, if you can believe it. Changed the dress code there at the age of 23. They didn't let women wear pants, if you can believe it, in the 90s. I went from there to like trying to get into the magazine business. And the only opening at the time at Time Inc. was Money Magazine. I was surrounded by Money Magazine and Fortune and Barron's and all that stuff because of Marty. I said, I knew this stuff. But let me tell you, I was definitely one of the only women of color. So that's how I ended up in media. That's how I ended up in personal finance. And then what the fire that was lit under me, even though I didn't necessarily like the topic of money, is that at Money Magazine is where I realized, man, these people have all this information. Who's telling us? Who's telling our generation? And who's telling us as Latinos, as Black Americans, as Asians, who's talking to us as women? And I just realized there was a big gap and that lit me on fire. And I was like, all right, I'm going to take this and run.
So career-wise, things were happening, right? Things are like taking off. And so, you know, if your career is taking off and everything is going so well and you're like in personal finance, which is incredibly demanding as a journalist as well, somewhere along the line, you're like, and I also want to be a mom myself. And you were determined. You write about how your mom was often quite hard on you. And your mom did make you essentially be a second mom to your younger siblings, four of them.
Yep.
There are a lot of women who'd be like, ¿sabes qué? I raised my four younger sisters. I'm done with it.
Yeah.
There was a desire in you to have a child. And I want to know where that came from after having raised your four younger sisters.
Well, notice I only have one child. I was determined even at, you know, before my second marriage, when I was in my early 30s, I said, oh my God, if I hit 35, I'm building an adoption fund, like a savings account. Like that's how much I was like, I'm going to do this on my own. I can do this, blah, blah. And my daughter came along at an incredibly difficult time. The first year and a half of her life was very difficult for me because I became the main breadwinner. And as you know, in the TV world, it takes a lot from you and it takes a lot of time from you, a lot. And I guess I should say that I've pretty much made it my motto after those couple years and the show ended to make her the focus of my life and to kind of make up for those first 2 years. I didn't want that to happen.
So another thing that you and I are pretty public about is that in this business, you have to believe in yourself incredibly. You have to fight through all of these battles. You have to have an ego. You have to manage the ego. You and I are passionate about our families. But this other thing that we share is, and we're okay to talk about, right? Which is there's a lot of sacrificing of our families. Mm-hmm. And you have been in this position. But I want to know a little bit more about how you understand how Latinas, in any business, but particularly in our business, what we sacrifice and how we manage that. Because a favorite word among Latinas, guilt.
Oh, gosh.
Guilty much?
Listen, Maria, I have done away with that G word.
Me too, honey. That girl me too. 100%. 100% done away with. But it is a cloud. It is a cloud that is over us for a long time.
Huge. And I think too, you know, because, and I'm going to say this, which, you know, this is probably something we share too, because I'm ambitious and I want to succeed, the two things can battle with each other. And what I did, though, was I made a difficult decision to step away from TV full time. And because I needed to be there, because all of a sudden I found myself a single parent.
I think one of the things we understand, Carmen, frankly, as we get older, right, is that we begin to understand our parents, right? And the really difficult, complex decisions that they made, we begin to understand, like, okay, this might help me to understand why they made this decision. And honestly, I wasn't expecting to ask you this question, but, you know, I just feel like I have to, and you and I are very open. We talk about everything. And one of the things that you and I have talked a lot about is sex and sexuality as women, as Latinas, as women of color. I guess where I'm going to is that as I read the book, I mean, your mom was an eminently sexual being. And I'm just kind of like, as you wrote this, how were you relating to that part of your mom?
She understood her power, the power of her body and attractiveness as a woman. She could be charming, but she was also cold and a little standoffish. And that was actually very appealing to a lot of men. She was kind of a force, but she was very much kind of a seductress, right? But when we moved to New Hampshire is kind of when it started to be extinguished within I'd say maybe 5 years. She went from wearing, you know, skimpy nightgowns at night where I'd be like, mommy, cover your boobs, man, you know? And she'd be like, oh, my tetas, you ate from them or something. And I'd be like, blah, you know, it's disgusting and inappropriate.
Such a Latina response.
Oh my God, so much, right? And I just was repulsed. But anyway, but it was also funny. But she went from that to just like covering herself up and shutting herself down. And, you know, that was also hard to see because that was the pressure of that place. New Hampshire didn't allow her to be that person. You can especially, I think, feel it and hear it initially when I tell the story of how she came home one day with a new hairstyle. And notice I have a couple of hair stories in here because as women of color, this stuff is very important. But, you know, in New Hampshire, she had to pull her hair back, not wear as much makeup, you know, cover herself up. And we kids were watching Sesame Street and Rita Moreno came on and she had this beautiful auburn afro. And my mother, Lupe, was like, oh, ay, mira que linda. And she was like fascinated by it. Next day, she comes home. She goes out for a few hours. She comes home. She has an auburn afro. I think it's cute. She's happy. The look on her face of pride and joy. And then Marty comes home. And he calls her upstairs. They disappear. And she comes downstairs with a scarf covering her hair. And her face is just gray. And I say, mommy, you know, what happened? And she says, he didn't like it. And she wore that scarf on her head until her hair grew long enough to again pull it back into a ponytail. So what that really showed me, even though my mother was, and I'm going to use this word, Maria, because it's absolutely true, and I didn't put my whole life in that book, but my mother was a very abusive person. There was abuse, there was trauma, there was a very difficult house. To see her in that moment, to see the crushingness of identity and how you present yourself, you know, as Latina, you know, Afro-Latina, how much we missed, right? How she could be herself in New York, but she couldn't be herself there. How she was trapped and she felt trapped with these four new little kids, you know, and why I was second mommy, because she couldn't handle it. And she had no friends, you know. We volunteered at the church maybe, but she didn't have those Friday night dance parties anymore. It enabled me to see that the reason why my mother was so abusive, which, by the way, it gets handed down, doesn't it? You know, handed down for generation to generation to generation. She had a lot of reasons to be angry and in pain. So though, you know, I don't necessarily forgive it or look back on it fondly, I understand where it comes from.
So I have to tell you, Carmen, that when I got to the end of the book, there was like this, I was like, this is my friend and she's been through a lot of trauma. And you are, you're such a survivor. In fact, you're one of the people who helped me in very, very dark times in my life. You really helped me. And of course, you have this fabulous smile. Of course, that's why you had a great career on television. So I want to know how you're processing the trauma and how it relates to this central question, which is, where do I belong? And that's the question that you're asking, right? Like, where do I belong? And it's a question that in your story, you acknowledge it's impacted by colonization, by the diaspora. I mean, how do you process the trauma that you now see, your search for identity, and frankly, living with and being at peace with the truth?
Well, the search for identity, I will say, I found a lot of peace with that, because, there's been a lot of clarity in the sense of this. When I found out, Papi Wang wasn't my biological father, a lot of people have, made comments about like, oh, you're not Chinese anymore, and da-da-da-da. I have really distilled, there's a very big difference, as you know, because we have a Chino-Latino, Asian-Latino community between race and culture. So, am I biologically race? Chinese? No. But I will always be a Wang. Always. That's not going to change. It's never changed. And I had to bury Papi a few months ago. And that definitely, even though he was a very difficult person, another abusive person, but man, did that make very clear to me that he was my father. Even though he didn't live with us, he didn't, but he was there. He was that presence. He called me up all the time. He was a pain in the ass. But you know what? He was the only one who called me up all the time. So there's a different way that each of these people and each of these men have formed me. And in terms of my identity, I very much realized that the outside world can look at me and see my phenotype, the expression of my genes, which is very much by chance. Look at my daughter, una blanquita, right? Who came out blonde with blue eyes. Look at my nieces who are black with the name Wong. And look at my family in those pictures in the book and be like, what the hell? We know who we are, right? And the outside world shouldn't be able to tell you. What I love about this young generation, because my daughter's 15, man, I love it. Maria, I love it. They say, this is who I am. This is how I want to be addressed. These are my pronouns. Like, this is what we need to do, because when that big culture in New Hampshire looked down on me and said, no, you're not this, you're that. That was painful. It's painful to not be able to say, no, this is who I am. So doing the book, coming to this point, yes, lots of therapy, and really kind of processing everything as I go along, it's been kind of amazing to land at the point where I just realized, nah, I know who I am.
Bueno, querida, I am so glad that you said yes to write this book and that you took all of us readers on this journey with you. And it's really been great talking to you. The book is Why Didn't You Tell Me? Congratulations again. And on everything that comes ahead, amiguita, and thank you for being such a truth seeker and a truth teller.
Same, mama.
Gracias, Carmen. This episode was produced by Julia Rocha and edited by Daisy Contreras. It was mixed by Gabriela Baez. Thank you to Random House Audio for the excerpt, Why Didn't You Tell Me?, read by Carmen Rita Wong, the author. The Latino USA team includes Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Marta Martinez, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., Alejandra Salazar, and Patricia Zulbarán with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Fernanda Santos. Our director of engineering is Stephanie LeBeau. Our senior engineer is Julia Caruso. Our associate engineer is JJ Carubin. Our marketing manager is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation fellow is Elizabeth Lowenthal Torres. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, María Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. Remember, no te vayas. And hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by New York Women's Foundation. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. And the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
We started out as colleagues and then, like, kind of quickly, I would say, kind of fell in love, like compañeras. Like, we were like, where you been all my life?